In this week's programme, Anglo-Irish relations in the early years of the Northern Troubles. Anthony Craig's book, Crisis of Confidence, focuses on the way security matters inevitably became central to the relationship. Sunningdale was a big step forward, but when it collapsed, Harold Wilson seriously considered British withdrawal. What put pay to that idea, according to Garrett Fitzgerald, was a chance meeting in West Cork in the summer of 1975 between Garrett himself, Wilson's successor Jim Callaghan, and Jack Lynch. With me, Ronan Fanning, Emeritus Professor of Irish History at UCD, Noel Dorr, former diplomat and Secretary General of the Department of Foreign Affairs, and Katrina Crowe, who's senior archivist with the National Archives. What did you make of Anthony Craig's book, Ronan?
Well, I thought it was research was very impressive. There was all kinds of fascinating detail. But I thought it was curiously skewed in lots of ways. And I thought the point you made in the introduction there about security, and there were real problems between security, between the British and Irish governments during this period. But I think because of his emphasis on that, he's in fact got the British-Irish relationship, the relationship between the British and Irish governments, I'm afraid, utterly wrong.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the relationship between the British and Irish governments from 1971 to 73 is improving and getting stronger all the time. And it really relates, and this is something he doesn't say a great deal about, it really relates to the collapse of confidence in Britain in the Northern Ireland government. For as long as the Northern Ireland government and the prime ministers, whether it's Faulkner or whether it's Chichester Clark, is being propped up, well, then they feel they can't really talk to Dublin. They can't really give Dublin a role.
Isn't he right in saying, that trade was put on the back burner?
I don't really think. I just don't think he sees the big picture at all.
Mm-hmm. No, Noel Dorr.
I agree with Ronan. I think there's some interesting research in it. He's very good on security. I noticed that Christopher Andrew, who's a specialist in security matters, I think intelligence matters, has
he's written
the foreword. He's possibly been his thesis supervisor. So good research on all of that. Some insights, some interesting things here and there, and some infelicities. But I'm afraid generally very disappointing, even shallow, I would say, on what for me was the major thing of this period, which was the Sunningdale Conference and the lead up to it. And he does say something very good about Sunningdale at one point at the end. He says that Sunningdale and the Council of Ireland may have been both a bureaucratic anticlimax and later a political failure, but in the realm of Anglo-Irish relations, it represents an incredible and indelible success.
And you would agree?
I would agree. Yeah, I mean, I was involved, I suppose. I was at Sunningdale, and I suppose I have personal memories and maybe even a degree of bias there. And I learned a good deal about the security background, which I wouldn't have been so familiar with in my role in foreign affairs. But nevertheless, if Sunningdale is as important as that sentence suggests, and I think it is, because I think it was indeed the beginning of the building, putting the building blocks in place, which led to the present peace in Northern Ireland, because I think each successive effort at a settlement built on the building blocks of the previous one and added to them, if that was that important, as he admits it is, then he should have had a lot more about it, whereas in fact he seems to be focused entirely at times on security and very little about the political economic side.
Katrina Crowe, can we hear you on your overall reaction to
well,
the book?
Well, it's a very narrowly focused book. He's attempting to look purely at the sort of key players in politics and in the civil service. So, for example, you get very, very little about the SDLP, who surely were important players, certainly from 1969 onwards, and not much about John Hume, who becomes one of the great sort of heroes of the peace process later on. I think Sunningdale is hugely important too, and he bookends the book with Sunningdale. He starts by telling a story about a busload of the participants coming back from a meeting. Paddy Devlin singing "The Sash My Father Wore" and Brian Faulkner singing "The Wearing of the Green," and how amazed the British were that this sort of interculturalism could go on between what should be sworn enemies. And you think, right, he's getting at something here, let's see how he develops it. And then at the end he does the indelible and incredible quote that Noel just mentioned. But also says categorically that Sunningdale really didn't have any effect on what happened afterwards. And that seems entirely counterintuitive. It was the template, I would have thought, for all that came afterwards, however painfully and slowly, in terms of constructing the ultimate peace process. But the other thing we're missing all the time is the conflict. As both of my colleagues have said here, it seems to intrude in a strange way into what should be a smooth passage of relationships between Ireland and Britain. I mean, it's like stating the bleeding obvious. Of course it intruded. It was the thing that dominated everything for 30 years and frightened the hell out of everyone at the beginning, because no one thought that it could possibly get as bad as it did. And it got as bad as it did very, very fast when you think of 1972 and what happened in that year. We don't get a sense of what was actually going on. And when you think of the recent revelations from Boston College, the tapes that were made from David Irvine and Brendan Hughes, who are participants in the conflict, and the sheer misery that they bring to us, you don't get the sense that Dr. Craig gets that. He must do, because everyone does. I mean, all you have to do is look at it. But it doesn't play a part in the book in any way.
How does he handle the comparative influence of Ken Whittaker and Eamon Gallagher on Jaglich?
I don't think he's got it entirely right, but he has used his interviews with Eamon Gallagher quite well, I think. Mm-hmm. I think he underestimates Whittaker's influence, although he does get the general pattern right. But in a more general sense, I think one of his real problems is he doesn't understand the Irish government's mindset. In fact, the mindset of people in Dublin, in the Republic generally. There's some extraordinary, just one or two sentences. Okay. He says, for example, at one stage, the Irish government demonstrated a lack of empathy for the RUC's position. Mm-hmm. Indeed, it demonstrated this to the Northern Ireland government generally. Well, I mean, surprise, surprise. And he seems to find this is in some way curious. I think he realizes he's got some very good interviews with a man called Kelvin White, who was the head of the Republic of Ireland department in the Foreign Office at the time. And he's bought into his view totally. And, you know, John Peck, for example, who is ambassador here, and who I would feel, and I think many other people would feel, did a very good job here in trying to explain to London what people thought here.
I want to return to John Peck in a moment, but first, Noel, can I hear you on the handling of the comparative influence of Ken Whittaker and Eamon Gallagher?
Well, I became involved around 1970, and I worked with Eamon Gallagher. And I think it's a good account of Eamon Gallagher, and obviously he had a lot of interviews with Eamon. There was a tough side to Eamon that he doesn't bring out. Eamon was sort of the mind that, as the Latin tag has it, si vis pacem, bellum parate, if you want peace, prepare for war. And he wanted the government here to be really prepared for a tough side in Northern Ireland. I looked up some notes of a discussion and argument with Eamon around that time that I have, and this was a rather tougher side that he doesn't bring out. I agree with Ronan on Kelvin White. Kelvin White, I know the name, and I'm not sure that I ever met him at the time, but he certainly wasn't the big figure that he comes out from this book. And let me just say, so many other things are left out here. There's very little about extradition, nothing about extradition, which is a major issue. Very little about the status of Northern Ireland, which is a big source of argument. Loyalist violence. There's so much.
Katrina, I think he's right. Ronan is right in saying that he downplays the importance of Ken Whittaker.
I'm not sure that's true. He does give Whittaker status as the chief advisor to Lynch up to a certain point. And Whittaker's strategy was to build closer relationships with the government in Northern Ireland. And that lasted up to a certain point. And one of the interesting bits in the book is where he forensically analyses one of the last speeches that Whittaker wrote for Lynch, which he delivered in Tralee in September 1969, where he goes through what Whittaker wrote for Lynch and then what changes Lynch made to it under the influence of Eamon Gallagher, who has now decided, as he calls it, to reverse the alliances and to build contact with the constitutional nationalists in Northern Ireland and with the British government instead of with the Unionist government. Now, that's interestingly done, and he does it again with Wilson's doomsday document later on in the book, the withdrawal document. But we get this sense of, I mean, I'm captivated by his description of Gallagher as somebody who, in his spare time, would travel up to Belfast at the weekends to meet the key players and do all of that. There's no doubt that he was somebody with an immense amount of passion about what was going on. But I think, as Noah Burroughs says parts of him are occluded from this description, even though he comes across very well.
One of the most entertaining parts of the book for me was Jorge's meeting with Andrew Gilchrist, the British ambassador, the day before the Bailey-Borough meeting in 1969, where he says there's nothing he wouldn't sacrifice for a united Ireland, including the position of the Catholic Church.
Certainly not very much evidence of that kind of attitude when Mr. Hoy was producing Irish solutions for Irish problems on the matter of conference.
Yes and no. Yeah. I was with Mr. Haughey in London when he met Margaret Thatcher for the first time in 1980. And he had a private tete-a-tete with her, and he came out from that full of ideas that everything was open and all sorts of possibilities. And I think some of what he said to Gilchrist was still in his mind at that time, that if, in fact, Mrs. Thatcher came along with the idea of working towards Irish unity, then all sorts of possibilities, Commonwealth, everything else seemed to be open.
But clearly Charlie Hoy was on a solo run, wasn't he,
at that time?
Yes.
Can I just come back to something that I think is very important and that isn't brought out at all in the book? He makes it seem at times that the concepts of power sharing and the Irish dimension were, so to speak, British ideas, which somehow the Dublin accepted. That's completely wrong. My memory of that time, very vividly, working with Eamon Gallagher, is that the idea that the Westminster model wasn't suitable for Northern Ireland, the winner-takes-all model, and therefore that you had to have some new and innovative approach, which would be power-sharing, was something that we worked on and pushed on the British in that period around 1970-71. And the Irish dimension, which came out, in fact, in Ken Bloomfield's Green Paper in 1972.
Was that was also, in the Whitelaw's time.
Yeah, that was a crucial idea, because, and it was something that we had been pushing too, because it meant two things. It meant that the Irish dimension and that the it was internal to Northern Ireland. It wasn't simply that the South had a claim on the North, but that there was an intrinsic aspect to Northern Ireland. The pieces wouldn't hold together unless you catered for the Irish dimension.
In other words, just to be clear about this, what Ken Bloomfield suggested, this was in 1972, was that any settlement must recognise Northern Ireland's position within Ireland as a whole.
You see,
was that new at the time, what Bloomfield was?
No, it was what we had been pushing for a long time.
Right. Yeah.
Because, you see, if there were some kind of a settlement a la Sunningdale, which didn't have that Irish dimension, then it would be what's called an internal settlement, and the SDLP couldn't go into it. So it was a leg of a tripod, so to speak, that was needed.
Yeah.
It also meant reopening. It seems to me it was just a phrase, but the phrase had great meaning because it reopened the issue of whether the whole thing was settled in 1921-22, and it was for the first time a recognition that the Republic was not extrinsic to the problem, but the relationship to the Republic was an intrinsic part of the issue in Northern Ireland.
Was there a difference? I picked up a difference of emphasis between Gallagher and Whitaker in terms of their advice, that Whitaker was focused more on Northern Ireland, on Dublin, Belfast, whereas Gallagher was thinking more of Dublin, London. Did you pick that up?
Well, Whitaker goes back to the Lammas O'Neill meeting, when everything looked a lot more rosy than it did subsequently. And he held on to that for quite some time. But also, of course, he was deeply involved in the AFTA talks. Craig makes the case, and it may be true, that those economic discussions brought the two governments closer than they would otherwise have been, and that they, of course, continued during periods when there might have been slight breakdowns in communications, which is an interesting thesis.
I mentioned, no
better than I if that's true or not. But Gallagher does change things hugely in terms of
that question of that difference of emphasis.
Yes, that's true. Because I can testify. I shouldn't perhaps say this, but even as late as the Anglo-Irish Agreement of 1985, talking to Ken Whitaker, he was rather worried that the effect of that was that the Irish that was a choosing of sides in Northern Ireland, that the Irish government was somehow speaking for the minority and the British government would then speak for the majority, whereas his view was that the Irish government should speak for everybody, so to speak.
Sure.
And he certainly would have had more emphasis, I think, on the North-South thing and on, if you like, finding a way to live with unionism rather than on the Anglo-Irish relationship.
So has Craig done useful work in picking up on that difference of emphasis, Ronan?
Yes, I would think so.
Yes. I mean, I think it doesn't compensate, I'm afraid, for the weaknesses. I mean, there are some extraordinary. I mean, he finds it surprising, reprehensible, what he describes as the sense of distance fostered by the Northern Ireland office, with Northern Ireland civil servants. And then he says, although Whitelaw did take on experienced Northern Ireland officials, civil service officials in 72, he says it took many more years for the British civil service to realise that it could fully trust Northern Ireland civil servants. A very large part of the problem was that neither Dublin nor London believed they could ever trust Northern Ireland civil servants. And they brought in people. And when the British started, exactly the same thing happened in Ireland in the spring of 1920, the indicator that when the British are beginning to take a problem seriously, they bring in their own people. They don't trust the indigenous post-colonial civil service.
I said I'd return to Sir John Peck. He really dumps on him in a way here, doesn't he? I mean, he says the point that the feeling was that he'd gone native. How does he handle Peck, Noel? What do you think?
I think very badly. Yeah. I think I agree with Ronan. I think the reputation, maybe it's because, of course, we were on the Irish side, one would say, to perhaps have a bias. But for me, John Peck was a big figure. I was relatively junior. I wasn't dealing direct with him, but he was the best ambassador, if you like, that in my memory. And certainly I feel very much here that we're getting Kelvin White's views.
Yeah,
and I don't have any sense from that time in my own memory of Kelvin White as a real player at all.
Why has Kelvin White assumed such importance?
Because he gave long interviews to Dr.
Exactly,
Craig.
Exactly, that's the trouble with the book.
And in fairness, he's very funny. He does at one point talk about Neil Blaney being a saturnine and aggressive presence at a meeting. Yeah. And he said he spilled his coffee over Collie and he was sorry that was a mistake. He should have spilled it over Blaney instead. So, I mean, he does make us laugh, but that is no excuse for... Yeah.
But actually, to give him his due, he does part... I mean, he does quote David Batherwick, who subsequently became British ambassador here. But at that stage, at the time when the British embassy was burnt down, he was junior. And he says, and he quotes him as saying, Peck, I think, unfairly got a reputation among the British as being sold on the Irish. What he contributed was being able to sympathise to a degree and see what was driving at the Irish at a time when there was absolutely no understanding of Irishry in London. Mm. Now, that's Blatherwick. And Blatherwick could, by no stretch of the imagination, be described as pro-Irish himself.
How important is it for him to say that Heath's main concern in 72, something perhaps we forget, was the miners' strike? I mean, we do tend to think that...
that's true. That's why Whitelaw was moved out in Northern Ireland.
You have to say that, and Robert Armstrong agrees with this, he was Heath's private secretary at the time. At Sunningdale, we all expected Heath to turn up and open the conference and then move away. He stayed on at Sunningdale, on and on and on over the 3 or 4 days of Sunningdale. And I think he had a visitor, it might have been the Italian Prime Minister or President, and he went back to Downing Street briefly and then came back again to the conference. And he did give a great deal of time. And now this was in December 1973. But he seemed to have been gripped by the issue, whatever his earlier attitude was. And I must say, his attitude at Sunningdale at the conference was more or less, if you can agree, we're all right with it. In other words, he didn't seem to be pressing too much a British position, but it was whatever the parties in Northern Ireland and, of course, the Irish government could agree was accepted.
Isn't that
true, and I think it's a very important point. I mean, the contrast, if you look at the papers in the Prime Minister's office, Heath's attention to detail, his notes on the file, his comments, his questions. Mm. Wilson never looked at anything.
Isn't that an interesting story about Heath coming to Baldonnell in 72 and the Director of Intelligence being asked to ensure that the chefs didn't poison him either deliberately, and I love this, or otherwise.
I was at that meeting as part of the Irish delegation, and I can tell you another little anecdote about it. The location was so secret.
The location was so secret.
The participants was so secret. That the press were not informed. There was a press centre set up in the Shelburne Hotel. And when the conference was coming to an end towards the press conference, they were to be all bussed out to wherever the centre was. But it turned out that when they all got on the buses and set out, nobody knew where they were going at that stage. So there was confusion. But it was an important meeting.
Yeah,
that,
72.
Yes.
We have forgotten, Katrina, the reality of British withdrawal. And the point he makes here, and I suppose he's right, that there was nothing was feared more in Dublin than a British withdrawal.
Quite rightly, yeah. You know, I mean, at the beginning of the book, it's 100 million a year into Northern Ireland. By the time Wilson makes his famous speech, "What kind of people are these?" it's 300 million a year. I mean, there would have been no chance that we could have taken on anything like that, apart from the horrible consequences.
He was thinking of a five-year orderly withdrawal.
With the threat of no Dosh.
Yes.
No wonder Gareth Fitzgerald was scared to bits about it.
He was thinking about that in the late 1960s as well.
Yeah.
It seems it was
he was dying to get out of there. Dying to get out of there.
I don't know whether Noel remembers this. I thought the interesting, I mean, we'd known about the withdrawal scare before from Bernard Donoghue's books and various other things. Mm. But one thing that I hadn't seen before, it's in the Irish archives, in the National Archives, was the Irish Army paper of the summer of 75, where some army officers had a few bright ideas about, you know, we would have to go in there. Mm-hmm. And this, of course, this was shot down. It was shot down largely by Dermot Nally.
Yeah.
And Nally emerges as... Nally was a very modest man, and he doesn't come out of the book the way he should, because he's obviously very modest in his interviews. Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Very much so. Dermot Nally was central in all of this, and he doesn't come out at all in this book in that way. And I think that's a huge gap. It shows again that he just interviewed, say, Eamon Gallagher, Kelvin White, and a few others, but there are so many others that it was a pity he didn't really.
In the event of withdrawal, he did interview Dermot Nally, but I think he didn't realise the significance. In the event of withdrawal, you had an IRA plan, you had an SDLB plan, SDLP, and the Irish government plan that you spoke about.
It wasn't Irish government, it was a kind of contingency planning by an army, which does plans these things anyway.
Yeah, by the way, that earlier military plan, what was it, based on a war game exercise Armageddon, some suggestion there that it gave the green light, which seems unlikely, to Haughey and Blaney. The idea that this was an Irish Defence Forces contingency plan at that time, isn't it, in the 60s?
I think just armies plan for things. That's their job, so to speak. And they may plan for far-out things. Mm. I don't attach too much importance to that. I wouldn't have been privy to that, I must say, at the time.
But it's also much less daft than the later one, in the sense that they do come to sensible conclusions about what's possible and what isn't in the earlier plan.
The later one, they seem to be in the grip of an onrush
of unsuitable patriotism.
What I think is interesting...
Far more than they could.
Sorry, Katrina. There are a few interesting things that... I think Ronan has written a bit about before, and maybe they're not as new as I thought they were, but he brought out the fact that the British preparation for direct rule was done much earlier. It wasn't something that followed Bloody Sunday, so to speak. It had been planned back in the 60s, yes. Yeah.
69.
And secondly, their internment. They were deeply involved in internment, and they wanted internment to come in before direct rule so that they wouldn't be blamed. Yeah. So it was a kind of clever ploy. Yes. It wasn't that they sort of yielded to the Northern Ireland government, but that they more or less went along with themselves.
I really like this Jesuitical line, Dublin would only intervene, sounds very sensible, doesn't it, if matters became so bad that an incursion would not make them worse.
Well,
delightful ambiguities and vagaries.
One thing I'd like to ask Noel, if he remembers this, because I was very interested in this, on the security front, he speaks about a kind of axis between the then Taoiseach in 73, Liam Cosgrave, and Paddy Donegan, about the Claudia,
and the
finding of the guns, the swooping on the Claudia and all of that. And it's quite clear that for a time, foreign affairs were kept out of the loop.
Yes.
They weren't told what was happening.
Yes. Yes.
And they only discovered what was happening by accident.
By the way, that...
from the British.
The idea of Garrett...
Do you remember that?
That meeting in 75 in West Cork. Is Garrett right in saying that chance meeting with Jim Callaghan and Jack Lynch, that put paid to the idea of a withdrawal?
I think it was very important. But I think, again, you see Armstrong. If you look at the index of the book, there's one reference to Armstrong, and it simply is that he's been sent something by Wilson. Armstrong was hugely important in saying, this is utter nonsense, this must stop, the withdrawal thing.
But
and he plays a huge role in that.
A chance meeting, no, in West Cork?
It wasn't a chance meeting.
I was out of Northern Ireland issues in foreign affairs at the time. Sure. I was dealing with European affairs, so I wouldn't have been.
He does use the term,
but I do accept
Craig does of chance meeting.
No, it wasn't a chance meeting.
Garrett
set that up because he holidayed in West Cork. He knew that Callaghan's son-in-law had a house in West Cork, and he knew Lynch was in West Cork. he set it up.
There was anything but chance. And you think it was significant? I suppose it was.
It was.
In terms of things.
Because I think the very fact that Lynch and Garrett were both saying the same thing, that, look, this is insane, I think that would have had an impact on
And Armstrong's on role, there have been a number of Armstrong
Armstrongs. Armstrong had the been saying this from day one.
Was this Robert or William?
Robert yes, Armstrong. Yeah. I mean, his role as Heath's private secretary, his role going way, way back, I mean, quite apart from his enormous role in the Anglo-Irish agreement in 1985, but his role in scuppering the withdrawal. Armstrong, for example, was utterly opposed to the introduction of internment. And as a relatively junior civil servant, he was Heath's, one of his private secretaries at the time, more or less said, Prime Minister, I don't understand why we're doing this.
Final word on nomenclature. As to what we call these islands, I've never heard before.
Iona.
The Anglo-Hiberno Archipelago is a new one on Beacon Street again.
I sort of like Iona, Islands of the North Atlantic.
Island, yeah. Did I ever take off? That was Ken Bloomfield, wasn't it?
Yes. No, I don't think, I'm not sure that it was Ken Bloomfield. It was being canvassed by The Guardian at the time. I remember that phrase quite well.
Islands of the
I'm
North
not a
Atlantic,
problem with
yes.
that, but my real problem with nomenclature is the troubles. It's like calling World War II
well,
the emergency.
That's a euphemism.
Let's call it the Long War stages of the Troubles.
There's one other thing. I think he ignores to a degree the degree of bipartisanship that existed on the North between Lynch's government going out of office in March 73 and the incoming government. I have material, and I was involved in preparing stuff on Council of Ireland and so on in December 1972, which is when Lynch was still in office, which pretty well resembles what went into
the How do you account for that bipartisanship?
Well, I think that Jack Lynch was quite sympathetic, having, so to speak, got rid of the more extreme element, perhaps, in his own government over the arms crisis. I think the realities of the situation in Northern Ireland impressed themselves on him as they did on the incoming government.
It's a bonus from the arms crisis, in a way, because the effect of the arms crisis is to create bipartisan policies in Northern Ireland between sensible Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And
we've been discussing Crisis of Confidence, Anglo-Irish Relations in the Early Troubles by Anthony Craig, published by Irish Academic Press. My thanks to Katrina Crow, Ronan Fanning and Noel Dorr. You can listen to the programme again on our off-the-shelf website at rte.ie. Till next week. Bye-bye.